Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hey everyone, and welcome to Raising Parents, the Parenting Science Insights podcast, produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We are champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Dina Sargent. Let's get started. Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode. Now, positive mealtimes are not only about nutritional requirements, they can also shape children's learning, development, health, and their well-being. But how do we create a structure in mealtime and adapt them as our child gets older? Well, here to help answer some of our questions is pediatric occupational therapist and author, Laura Dato. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, as a therapist, what's your role in helping parents gain some understanding and creating some structure for mealtime?
I work directly with families and take into account the family's culture, their needs, things that make that family unique, and work with them to help problem solve, to build routines into their family life that best support their child, their family, and their relationship between the parent and the child.
Mm-hmm. And what's some of the most common frustrations parents and sometimes even children sort of say when trying to create that positive structure?
I think I experience a lot of headbutting and frustration fighting between parents and kids. Parents have expectations that their children aren't able to meet, don't feel comfortable meeting, whether that's around the foods that they eat, how long it takes them to eat, whether or not they have a device at the table. That's a really big one these days, like an iPad or TV or something like that. And kids get frustrated with things like having to try new foods and participate in things that feel difficult for them. And so navigating that frustration is a big part of my job.
Now, that's such a great introduction to our topic today. Before we dive into it even further, I would love to get to know some of your recommendations as well as some of your interests by playing our show's favorite game, which is our little icebreaker. Now, to start off with, what is the most recent book that you've read?
I am reading right now The Body Keeps the Score, which is about the effect of trauma on like our nervous system and our body, and I just think is so interesting.
Okay, perfect. Now, what's a movie that you would recommend to some of our viewers here today?
Oh, that's a good one. I really like the movie Patch Adams. I feel like that's probably a really niche one. But Robin Williams plays a doctor. And that was part of what inspired me to be an occupational therapist, actually, was that movie.
Oh, wow. It's amazing that you got how much you got from that, how much you learned from that movie and how much it inspired you to literally be where you are today.
It really touched me. I don't know. It's always stuck with me.
Oh, perfect. Now, could you name a podcast that has stood out to you in the recent years or the recent weeks?
So honestly, I am really new to the podcast world, and I haven't listened to any podcasts yet. But if you have any recommendations, I am very open to that. That's something that I'm looking to get more into, but I've just never found one interesting yet.
I could definitely list a bunch, none from the top of my head, because all of them right now are the stupid, silly podcasts that I listen to when I have free time. But yeah, I could definitely list a few later on. Now, who is a person that you find yourself looking up to, either in your professional life or even your personal life?
In my personal life, it is my grandmother. She has just always been there for me, and she is struggling with dementia right now. But even through that has just stayed really positive and really seeks out her family connections, which is something that I really value.
Oh, that's an amazing, very inspirational as well, actually. Sort of you see that connection between a grandparent and a granddaughter. I think that's a very special connection as well. Now, during your academic pursuit, what's been one course that has really stuck out to you?
My favorite course that I've taken in the last year or so has been a course on, I got certified in being a trauma responsive therapist. And that's been something that I feel like I use in all of my practice day to day, which you may not think would really relate to eating and feeding. But what I find is that when parents have difficulty with feeding their child, that can be really traumatic. It can be scary and feel like a lot of pressure. And so I end up using those skills that I gained from that class with all of my patients, even if they haven't had like a more traditional definition of trauma in their lives.
Mm-hmm. No, I can definitely see how trauma sort of relates to what you do, especially sort of dealing with the trauma of lack of understanding as to what a certain diets mean to them or disorders that they might have as well. So it might be traumatic. I can definitely see how that relates. And no, that's a incredible sort of duo team in what you're studying and how you picked up from that. So no, that I love that. Now, I know that parenting is a very difficult word to sort of define. Everyone has their own different understanding as to what being a parent is and to what parenting is. What would your definition in parenting be?
For me, it's really guiding my child to be the best version of himself, whatever he wants that to be, to make him the most independent and strong and happy version of himself that he can be.
Oh, I love that definition. It's such an underrated sort of definition as to what being a parent and what the role of a parent is, especially in today's age where you sort of see so many different ways that you can be a parent, so many different rules and regulations that you sort of have to step in and allow your child to sort of be in the world, but also don't coddle them too much. So I love that sort of temperament where you're just allowing the child to be the best that they can be. And I think that's the biggest thing that we can pick up from today's way that we do things today. Now, what would you think expectant parents would need to be aware of in their transition to parenthood?
I feel pretty uniquely capable of answering this question because I just transitioned to parenthood this year. My son is five months old.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I have just made that transition myself. And I think the biggest thing for me and that my husband and I have talked about is the preparation that we did beforehand and while we were expecting, of talking about, well, if this sort of situation comes up, how do we want to handle it? What are we going to do? What are we going to say? And got on the same page about a lot of different things. Then obviously we can't predict everything that's going to happen. Unexpected things happen in parenting all of the time. But having that really strong foundation of, in this sort of scenario, we've discussed this. We know how we want to handle it. We're of one mind on how we want to approach this, what we want the overall tone of our response to be, I think has cut down on what could have been a lot of frustration for us had we not done that, and has made a lot of parenting things feel really seamless, even when we are exhausted and it's 3 a.m. and we haven't slept yet that night because baby's been fussy or whatever it is that's come up. Having that strong layer of communication has been really helpful.
No, I love that because I think it's so important to create that foundation, and the communication must be a whole lot easier now sort of going 5 months in and knowing exactly where each of you stand in certain issues. And I think that's, communication is very underrated, and I know I will say underrated quite a lot, and I do say it quite a lot in every episode that I'm on, but communication is like the basis of a lot of relationships, let alone a lot of families. So being on the same page, I think I definitely find that commendable as to how early you sort of set, you both sort of had that communication. So that's great. I love that.
I'm sure we'll have more challenges as he gets older. Right now he's still small. Yes. We can put him somewhere and leave and come back and he's still there. But hopefully we can continue to carry that on as he gets older.
Yes. Well, it sounds like a great start to begin with. So I love that. And the way you sort of communicate, that's great. Now, we're going to start with a little bit of the basics of our episode here today. What would you define mealtime routines and structure?
When I think about mealtime routines and structure, I think about things that families do before meals, during meals, and after meals. For children, it's really important to have routine, to have the mealtime routine start before the food is on the table so that they can come to the table calm, regulated, focused, ready to participate in a family mealtime. If kids are really busy, really distracted, coming to the table already really hyped up or really upset, really exhausted, it's going to set the family up to have a lot of conflict and frustration. So my mealtime routines, when I'm working with families, start long before the food is on the table and then have a clear endpoint after the mealtime as well.
Okay. And why is it important for promoting healthy eating habits?
I think the mealtime routine is helpful for healthy mealtimes, both for children and for adults, right? If we don't have an expected mealtime routine, if we haven't, for adults, grocery shopped, planned a meal, cooked that meal, we're more likely to do things like go out and eat, get fast food, just throw something together that's maybe not nutritionally complete from the cabinet, whatever we have laying around the house. And for kids, the way that that mealtime routine comes in is they know what to expect. They know they come to the mealtime prepared to maybe try a new food, maybe to eat something that may not be their favorite, but is healthy for them. And it sets up the family to be able to have important family conversations and family bonding and all of that cultural aspect that we share during mealtimes can get missed if we don't have that routine solidly in place.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about having a mealtime routine, what are some of the key elements that sort of create and set it up a positive and successful routine?
Yeah, so I think that can look a little bit different based on how old your child is. But I am a big fan of including your child in all aspects of this in a way that is developmentally appropriate for them. So obviously that's going to look different at 2 than it is at 13, 15, 17. But things that I would consider as part of a good mealtime routine would be having your child involved in some aspect of the preparation of food. So for a 2-year-old, that might be that they're responsible for bringing forks to the table, and that's all they do, and that's okay. Or they help you stir before you put something into a bowl, whatever that is. A 13-year-old may be responsible for helping prepare a side or help make your grocery shopping list. And then setting up the mealtime so that everyone is coming to the table ready to focus on the meal. We're not, as parents, distracted on our phones. We don't have kids distracted by the TV, by homework, playing a game. And during the meal, we have an expectation of we all try a little bit of everything that's been prepared, even if it's not our favorite. So we're learning those new tastes, exploring those new foods, widening our horizons in that way. Connecting with each other during the mealtime through communication, talking, catching up on our days, whatever that looks like. And then some sort of activity that marks the end of the meal. So for a toddler, that might be something like, we're going to sing a song and go wash our hands. For a teenager, that might be, we're going to clean up the table and clean up the dishes, go wash dishes, whatever that is. But something that marks the end of, okay, this is the end of our family time. Now we're going to transition into doing whatever it is that your family does after meals.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of sort of setting up very early on, I guess, and sort of like instilling a lot of the behaviors a bit early on before they get to a teenager and suddenly, okay, this is what we're going to start doing now. So a lot of it is sort of embedded when they're a bit younger.
You know, I think it's never too late to start a new routine. But you're probably going to get a lot less pushback the earlier you start to try and get teenagers on board to start a whole new thing. It can take a little bit more time, a little bit more dedication, and that's okay. But it's good to know that going in that it could be a little frustrating for a little bit longer, and that's something to be prepared for and not give up on.
Mm-hmm. And now, what are some of the common challenges that parents often encounter when attempting to establish mealtime consistencies?
Yeah, I think implementing any change, no matter the age of your child, honestly, can be difficult. Kids like to, they like routine. And so they like to hold on to whatever their previous routine was as well. So if their previous routine was always that they were, just as an example, watching television during mealtime, they're going to be frustrated to have to change away from that. If their previous routine was that they only eat chicken nuggets and french fries and they don't eat vegetables, they're going to be frustrated to move away from that and have to try new foods. And so I think just implementing that change, getting started, is the hardest thing. And once you've gotten started, it just gets easier from there.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back because I love the way that you were saying earlier about letting your child sort of be a part of the preparation, or teaching them to just know and observe, like teaching them to join in when it comes to creating foods. So what would be some of the techniques that you would allow a child to motivate them in sort of inspiring them a little bit more to help with the cooking or to help be a part of that? Because I know, like growing up, especially for me growing up, there was that whole idea of, okay, if I join in helping, I'm going to create a lot of mess. So there's that idea of like, okay, if the child helps, they're going to mess up a little bit. How would you sort of allow it to be positive in a way of sort of helping them out?
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Their mess is inevitable with kids, right? Honestly, no matter what you're doing, if you're out in the yard, if you're in the kitchen, kids are going to make a mess. And I think as parents, we've all sort of been raised with this expectation of, as children, we had pressure on us to keep things clean. And that's a generational change that we're making right now. And so it's natural for us as parents to feel uncomfortable with that, because it's different from how we were raised. But I think about having that mess as it's an example of learning. And it's really important, the same way that when kids are doing arts and crafts, they're learning fine motor skills and they're learning their visual motor skills and their planning and their shapes and all of those things that are beautiful. But they're also making a huge mess. They're getting glitter everywhere and glue everywhere, and they get marker on the table, and all of those things happen. That being said, I am also a neat freak. So there are things that we can do as parents that can help lessen the intensity of that for us, whether that is putting a tablecloth under the area that you're working so you can just pick that up and take it outside and hose it off when you're done, or involving your child in cleanup so that they learn about the consequences of making those messes, and can help with the cleanup of that as well. There are things that we can do to help minimize that, but that mess is something that comes up for sure.
And so when sort of dealing with that and trying to communicate to a child, okay, the flour goes in the bowl and they're suddenly like spraying everywhere. That was one of my biggest childhood memories for me, with my sister and I learning to bake with my mom and sort of creating all of that mess and throwing flour everywhere. It sort of, for me, honestly, was one of the main things I remember from a childhood was how much fun we had with the flour being everywhere around the ground. So I guess it not only sort of allows a child to learn where it goes, but it also creates a whole lot of childhood memories that you still remember later on down the road about, this is what flour looks like when it's down on the floor.
Exactly. And now you have those really positive associations. You have the positive connection with your family and the positive connection with cooking, which I would guess as an adult means that maybe you're more likely to participate in cooking and baking and taking care of yourself in those ways, exploring those healthy foods, than maybe someone who was discouraged from being in the kitchen and now as an adult doesn't have those skills or that confidence, or had really negative memories of that and says, oh, now that I'm an adult, I don't want to do that anymore.
And so how does mealtime, like the routine and setting the routine in, does it also allow for children to sort of have the autonomy and sort of deciding what they get to do, where they get to sit, what they get to eat for dinner, for example?
You know, I think that's a really fine line. We want kids to have autonomy But we also need to guide them, because if children are allowed to make entirely autonomous decisions, they may end up eating chicken nuggets 7 days straight, or making a huge mess, or only drinking chocolate milk, or something like that. Because they don't have that wide base of knowledge that we do as adults. And so I think it's really a balancing act of finding ways that you can encourage their autonomy, but also guide them. And so something that I like to do is offer choices so that we can help guide. So, you know, we could say, we're going to have a vegetable with dinner. We're going to have a fruit with dinner. Which one do you think it should be? Should we make the broccoli or should we make the asparagus? Now, they're involved in the cooking. They have some buy-in. They're now excited to eat that food because they chose it. If they're older, maybe they helped prepare it, found a recipe for it. But we've still not given them full carte blanche to just make whatever decision they want out of a pool. And, you know, similarly with where they sit at the table, if that's something that makes sense in your family and you're comfortable with them choosing, great, go for it. If it's really important to you that the head of the household sits at the head of the table, I work with some families for whom that's a really important part of their culture, then maybe that's not something that they get a choice about, but maybe they can choose which color plate they have or which utensil they're using or something like that. You can find choices and buy in for them in ways that work for your family.
So alongside a lot of some of the misconceptions that you've probably heard in your line of work, some of the different myths that you've heard about healthy eating and mealtime structure, do you have any that you would like to sort of talk about and just try to debunk with us here today?
I have several. I'll share two. One is just force feeding being a good thing in general. I think a lot of families, a lot of us as adults, our generation was raised with this expectation of you're going to eat whatever's on your plate, regardless of how much you like it, regardless of if it makes you throw up, regardless of if you're going to sit at the table crying for 2 hours because you don't want to eat it, regardless of if you're full, you're going to clear your plate. And a lot of those things, now that we've had more research and more time, I don't think our parents knew this, but our generation really gets to benefit from this explosion of knowledge around parenting. And what we found is that having those practices in place actually decreases children's likelihood to try those foods. It creates negative associations with them. And having that negative association makes kids less likely to want to try it and less likely to eat it long term. I think of really all parenting strategies as we have short term or long term. And what's our goal? So short term, it might make that child eat that food, right? Like if you tell them they can't get up from the table until they've eaten it, they'll eat it. Eventually, it might take a couple hours. There might be tears, but they'll eat it. But long term, that's not creating a positive association with that food. That's not creating a healthy practice. And so doing strategies that benefit the long term often don't have short term results. You have to stick with them. They take a lot of work. But then long term, the end goal can be that your child has a really positive association with that food, with the concept of trying new foods. And so that's something that I think about a lot in my practice.
So before we move on to the second set of questions, what would be the second myth or misconception that you find yourself wanting to talk about today?
Yeah, so that one is that if you try a food once, and you don't like it, you're never going to like it, or you just don't like it as a person. We get new taste buds every 2 weeks or so. And so our tastes and preferences are constantly changing and are changing in response to the foods that we eat. So if you eat a food consistently, even if you don't like it at the beginning, your body will adjust and learn to like that food. And so I always tell kids and their families that based on research, it takes about 15 times of trying a food before you learn how to like it, something that you don't like at first. And so it's important to keep trying and trying and trying. When you're a parent and you offer your child a food and they say, oh, I don't like it, it feels really off-putting. And you're like, oh, I don't want to keep offering you this because it feels like a waste. It feels like we're not getting anywhere. And offering a food 10, 15 times can feel like a lot. It feels like a slog. But I don't want parents to give up. Continuing to offer that food really can help their kid learn to like new foods. And so it's a myth that if you try something once and you don't like it, that you'll just never like it, or your body just inherently doesn't like it. It's all a learned skill.
And that ties in perfectly with your book as well, in talking about raising adventurous eaters and sort of bringing in a whole different concept of allowing them to keep trying and not giving up on picky eating. Because I know a lot of kids, like for me, I have a lot of friends whose kids hate broccoli and they cannot stand because it looks green, it looks weird. But I think a lot of my friends have found recipes that are just allowing them to sort of sneak it in without allowing broccoli to be seen. So is that one of the ways that you would recommend allowing a child to sort of try it? Is that sort of on the end of forceful eating, or is that just something that's allowing them to taste it without knowing that it's there?
So I think that you can do that, but it doesn't always actually create a positive association with that food. And what it can do is negatively impact the trust that you have between you and your child. Because if they find out that you've been sneaking it in there, now suddenly they feel like, well, I don't know if I trust the other foods that you're giving me. Do I have to question what's in them? And it can actually lead back to more picky eating. You know, we talk about short-term strategies versus long-term. Short-term, that gets them to get broccoli. They have the taste of it. They try it. They may even be developing a taste preference for it because they've had that exposure. But long-term, it's not teaching them that they like broccoli, because if they see a broccoli, they're not going to associate it with maybe the pureed broccoli sauce or whatever it is that you make. So in their head, they're still going to say, I don't like this food. And then it can also negatively impact their desire to explore and try new foods, because they're constantly going to be questioning, well, did mom or dad sneak something into this? I don't know. Maybe I should be more wary of trying it. So I don't often encourage families to sneak it in that way. But something that you can do is encourage your child to explore with the food at whatever level they feel comfortable. So knowing that it can take 15 times, we're not in a big rush, right? It's a marathon and not a sprint. Maybe the first time you present broccoli and they say, oh, that's disgusting, I hate it. Maybe the first thing what you guys do is you have them smell it. They get used to the smell. Maybe they lick it. So they get a little bit of the taste, but they don't actually have to chew it up. Or maybe you can sort of progress up. So maybe we start by sniffing it. Maybe we start by feeling it. We crush it up so we can see what it's going to feel like in our mouth when we chew it up. Because for a lot of kids, like the texture of a food can be really off-putting, especially something like broccoli. It has two textures, right? The stem has a texture and then the floralet texture. So they can get used to the texture, they can get used to the smell, they can lick it and start to think about the taste. Then maybe they practice chewing like a tiny, tiny bite. I tell kids, like, it can be barely visible. It can be almost invisible. It can be so tiny, but they get their brain used to the idea of trying this food and feeling safe and comfortable with it. Maybe they chew up a bite and spit it out, which I know for our generation, a lot of parents are really uncomfortable with. We were told, like, at least I know I was told, if it goes in your mouth, you're not spitting it back out. That's gross. It's poor table manners. And it is, but it's really good for learning for kids to practice that and know, if I put this in my mouth and I feel like I've gotten in too deep, I don't feel safe, I don't feel comfortable, I know I can get myself out of that situation by spitting it out. Kid feels safe and comfortable exploring, they're going to be more likely to explore than if they feel like, oh, if I get in too deep, I'm going to be stuck. And so I better be more hesitant. I better be more cautious. There's also good research that using dips and sauces increases particularly vegetable and meat consumption. So maybe they have a favorite sauce. Maybe they really like ranch dressing or barbecue sauce or something like that. They could dip their vegetable in that. That can help be sort of a carrier for the taste. All of this to say that there are lots of ways that a child can explore a food before just being presented it as part of the meal. And all of those ways of exploring the food don't necessarily include eating it to start out with.
Okay. No, it's interesting because a lot of my friends are sort of having the very same issue with their kids in just allowing them to explore it in their own time. However, as they get older, there's that whole idea of, okay, what if they're never going to eat it? What if they're never going to absolutely sit down and try it? So it's good to know that there is that time period where they're allow some flexibility in teaching a child to see food on the positive end rather than just seeing it as a negative influence or negative introduction. So no, that's a really good concept to sort of know that 15 times it takes. So they have some time. I can let them know they have some time.
Yeah. And 15's the average. So for every time they like a food less than 15 times, there's going to be a time it takes more than that too. And that's okay.
Perfect. Now, for parents who want to learn more and implement some effective mealtime routines, could you recommend some resources, either books or even some experts that you can name here today?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite experts is Jill Castle. She's a dietitian and has written several books, and she has her own podcast that she invited me to be on as well, which was wonderful. But listening to her podcast, reading her books, she has resources on her website. Those are wonderful. There are, if you are interested in classes, some of them are a little bit more clinical, but there's also some parent-friendly ones as well at Talk Tools. It's a website, talktools.com. I really love their classes as well. I think those would probably be my favorite resources right now. Unfortunately, okay. I think there's sort of a lack of resources out there, which is part of why I wrote a book, is I had so many families tell me, this is really challenging, this is really difficult, I don't feel like there's anything out there. And I looked to find resources for them, and I couldn't. And so that was what prompted me to be like, well, I'm going to make some so that I have somewhere to refer families when they need it.
No, that's amazing. I think having an amount of resources, especially in this day and age where kids are a lot more forceful in saying that they don't want to eat things, they don't want to try new things, they're allowed to speak up a little bit more than I remember I used to speak up as a kid. So
for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And research shows that 25 to 45% of kids have difficulty with eating. And obviously difficulty can be really broad, right? Like that could be problems with swallowing, problems with chewing, really picky eating, nutrition, all sorts of things. But still, if you think 45, that's a high number. And I think a lot of families have sort of suffered in silence up until sort of recently because they felt, I don't know if it's shame or guilt or just like there weren't places to turn to. And so just knowing that if that's something that's difficult, you are not alone with that. And it is the community not having enough resources that's failing you, not the other way around.
Well, it's good to know that there's growing resources and there's still up and coming knowledge that we're still trying to find out on children and eating, and especially in this day and age where we're trying to, there's so many different ways that a child can try new things. So I think the amount of resources would be so good, and the growing resources that we have would be incredible.
Yeah, we've really had an explosion in research and parenting knowledge in the last decade. I'm excited to see where that takes future generations.
Yes, no, for sure. I think it's important for us to realize the fact that we're all just still trying to find things out. And every new parent, every coming up to be a parent is always going to be learning new things and always going to be learning. Exactly. So going on to our practice and habit part of the show, I know that we've mentioned a few practices that you would do to introduce a child to new foods. Would you have any other way that would enable a child to, sit down at the dinner table for one? How would you sort of get them to understand that there's no phone on the table, there's nothing there? What would be a practice that you would recommend for our parents to try today?
Yeah. I think the biggest things around that are setting clear expectations. So you have rules for the family. That might be something that you write down and you have visible for the entire family. Maybe it's something that you put onto your fridge or keep at the dinner table. And you can make those rules something that can be developmentally friendly. So if you have toddlers, maybe they don't know how to read yet. Maybe you take pictures to demonstrate those rules. You take a picture of them sitting quietly at the table. You take a picture of them eating their food with their utensils, being neat, using a napkin, whatever those rules are that you want to instill for your family. If they're teenagers, maybe they help write it down themselves so that they're involved in that as much as possible. And then the key is that you all need to practice them. If you as a parent are checking your phone, are logging in for work, are getting distracted, are even things like continually getting up and going to the kitchen to, oh, we forgot napkins, I'm going to go grab those. Oh, we forgot food, I'm going to go get that. Oh, we, whatever it is, right? We always are running around. That's sending the message to our kids that it's okay to get up and run around during meal times, which is not what we want to instill, right? So making sure that as parents, whatever expectations we have for our kids, we're setting those as well. Whether that expectation is sitting at the table, participating in conversation, not using a device, trying foods that we don't like, whatever that is, we need to do that as parents if we want our kids to do it too.
So it's pretty much a lead by example kind of situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Perfect. Now, what are some of the challenges that can occur when trying to allow all those, trying to set those rules up?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of parents really struggle with that. I think a lot of families come to, I'm a feeding therapist, will come to feeding therapy and say, I'm a really picky eater myself. I don't want my kid to struggle with the same things that I've struggled with. I want them to like a bunch of foods. Let's work on that. But then when they're sitting at the dinner table, they're not willing to try the broccoli, to try the asparagus, whatever that food is. They just want their kid to. But kids are little sponges and they're constantly learning from us. And they're learning by watching, learning by listening. And so if we say, oh, I don't like that, I don't want to try it, they're learning in their head that narrative as well. Oh, I've tried that, I don't like it, I don't eat it. And so just making sure that we're really doing the things that they ask and are confronting the things within ourselves that we need to do that. So if we know, I really want my child, here's an example for me personally, I don't like fish. I have never liked fish. And I have not honestly put in much of the work to try to learn how to like fish. I don't eat a lot of meat in my diet anyways. And so it's not something that I have worked very hard to add in. I know I could learn to like it if I wanted to, but I would like my son to be able to eat it because it's a healthy meat, right? It's good variety. And so my plan with that is if I need to have like a personal gross out moment, I'm going to have that before we're at the table. And when we're at the table and we're eating it, I'm going to take my bite and I'm going to keep a blank face if that's all I can do. If I can find something positive to say about it, then I will. But I'm going to model the behaviors that I want for him and do whatever processing of that I need to, whether that's thinking about how gross it is or how I don't like the smell or whatever. Do that on my own time and not in front of him so that I can model those appropriate behaviors for him as much as I can.
That is, thank you for sort of sharing your own personal steps and sort of introducing that as well, because I think it's nice to sort of see your own examples, to see how you would take it, to see how you would understand it. So no, thank you for that. And I definitely relate to that in terms of, I don't think my mom ever liked asparagus growing up, no matter what. And I think growing up, we never really had it that often because it was not something that she liked. So when she did the grocery, she wouldn't add it to the list. She wouldn't sort of put it in the grocery list. And as an adult, that's when I think when I was about 17, 18, that's when I first really tried asparagus myself. And it was amazing. I've never found any vegetable that I liked more than that. So it's a whole lot of trying it out as a adult now. And I'm like, I'm obsessed with asparagus. Every single time there's a chance, I'm like jumping at it.
Yeah, I had the same journey with Brussels sprouts. My parents also didn't like that. And now it's like one of my favorite vegetables. I love it so much.
Oh, I love Brussels sprouts in the air fryer and just that cook. Oh, it's so good.
Roasted, just crispy. Oh, so good.
Yes. So, yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And now we're going to move on to our open mic section of the show, which allows you to talk about something that you're passionate about, sort of talk to the audience directly. In the last minute or so, I'd love to get to know what's on your mind today for our talk.
Yeah. So the thing that really has been on my mind lately is the mental health crisis for kids since COVID. Statistics show that mental health illnesses and struggles have just skyrocketed since the pandemic, whether that's exacerbated by we have more things to be anxious about in the world. There are more things that kids are worried about. Kids have been more isolated, less engaged in social activities. And that has led to some really huge stressors for kids. We've also had adults with a lot of stressors. A lot of people have lost their jobs, have lost family members. And all of that is playing out on, with kids as well. And I think we have had, up until now, I know a phrase that I hear a lot is, well, kids are resilient. And they are, but that doesn't mean that they aren't feeling those stressors and they aren't experiencing the negative side effects of all of that. And so I just encourage everybody to not dismiss kids' difficulties with this thought of, well, kids are resilient, or that, oh, they'll get over it, or whatever it is. That these things are really important, and it's important to reach out and get help for yourself if you need it, to get help for your kids if they need it, and to take those struggles really seriously, because we're seeing some really scary and negative statistics around mental health for kids these days. That's just something that I take really seriously and I'm really passionate about.
No, I agree. I absolutely hate the phrase kids are resilient. I usually ban it from ever being as a phrase on the show, because it's even though they should be, okay, yeah, they are resilient, but they shouldn't have to be, especially as kids. To my point, they shouldn't have to be resilient. They shouldn't have to be dealing with all these emotions at their ages, especially after COVID, especially after all the stuff that they had to endure. I mean, even me as an adult, I'm 25, I still can't get over the fact that it was that long in the situation that we were in.
And so if we can't imagine the kids, adults with a lifetime of knowledge and support and resources and autonomy and all of those things, how can we expect kids to without that lifetime of experience, without those skills, without fully developed brains? It's not fair.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think kids' mental health, especially after all those situations, it's definitely going to be something that's going to last with them for a very long time, unfortunately. And it's, unless they are willing to speak about it, there's not much that a lot of parents are trying to find ways to deal with that. I know a lot of my friends who have kids who had literally started school online, and that was their whole social experience. And then the first day they went to school, they were in grade three and barely able to meet anyone, barely able to talk to anyone. So it's amazing at the fact that we're just stick them back at school like nothing's happened. So thank you so much for talking about that. I think that's, I'm a huge advocate for kids' mental health, especially on the show every single time it's mentioned. I'm also a huge advocate for especially the life after COVID. I think that's sort of something that we are still trying to process as well. I know I'm still trying to process a lot of it, so cannot imagine on a kid's point of view. So thank you so much for sharing that. Now, if there's a way audience members would like to get in touch with you to either talk about your book, talk about your job, or talk about, even ask questions that I might have missed, is there a way that they are able to get in contact with you?
Absolutely. I have a Facebook and Instagram page called Raising Adventurous Eaters, and that's probably the best way to get hold of me. I try to be pretty responsive on there. It may take me a couple days, especially with a 5-month-old. I am not always running out a lot of sleep here, but I am always happy to chat about ideas, to try and help where I can, to answer questions, anything like that. And I do have my book that's out that has a lot of information, more than we could go into tonight, or I guess this morning for you, but more than we could go into today. Has more information in there as well.
Well, thank you so much, Lara, for joining me on the show today. I know we spoke about got the gist of everything. We didn't talk a lot deeper into things, but maybe that can be for another episode. It was amazing talking to you. And if anyone has any questions, feel free to reach out to Lara and ask her, because I know that there's going to be a huge lot of things that I still have not mentioned. So definitely go and check out her book as well. It's amazing. It's colorful as well. I wish I could have it like holding right here and just show you, but it's amazing. And I was reading a little bit about it. It has so many resources to answer so many questions that I definitely have, especially when it comes to picky eating. So thank you guys so much for listening. I'll see you all in the next episode. You've been listening to Raising Parents, the Parenting Science Insights podcast, produced by the Parenting Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes are available from 10 life management perspectives and can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcasting apps available on your devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating our show, sharing it, and subscribing to our channel, as it helps other people find it so that we can grow and bring you more quality resources. More of our work can be found on our website at pa.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Dina Sargent. Thanks for tuning in.